Christina Butler from Sibsels here.
Great. Hi, Christina.
Hello.
I also have Megan Sylvester in the room with me today. So it was from Sibsels, did you say?
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Great. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you.
We might just give folks a few minutes to call in, and then we'll go ahead and get going. How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Good.
I believe Atlee and Lori from Sibsels were on the call yesterday, so I'm going to go ahead and fill in today for them.
Okay, great, great. Yeah, we had some good discussion yesterday. Hopefully we will today, too, get a few other folks on the line. Just trying to grab my list here real quick. Yeah. Good morning. Who do we have on the line?
Good morning. This is Lori Hill with the Coastal Bend Center for Independent Living.
Hi, Lori. We're just waiting for a few other folks.
Okay. I'm gonna punch some buttons and get you on speaker real quick. I hope I don't hang up. If I do, I'll call back in.
Yeah, no worries. The only thing is, don't anybody put us on hold.
Okay.
Just don't put us on hold and we'll be good.
Okay, let me see what I'm going to do.
Speaker. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, and you're on speaker, and
sure it is.
I'm thinking I can just hang up the handset, and it should retain, right?
Should.
Okay. There we go. We're on.
Yay!
Sure.
Anyway. All
right. Thank you.
Just talking about technology, and somebody Carissa yesterday with DSHS was trying to call in and didn't push some right buttons and muted herself and couldn't figure out unmute. So.
And when we actually start the conference, I will put myself on mute so you can't hear what's coming in from my end. And
that's great.
Or knock on phone ringing.
That'll be great.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good morning. Who just joined our call?
It's Tanya Lavelle.
Oh, hi, Tanya.
Yeah. Hi.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah.
Is your last name L-A-V-E-L-L-E?
Yeah, like V, like Violet.
Okay, great. Thanks. That's what I was hoping that we would have Marty or Greg, Jeff, and John. So we had four people that were on the original work group. How did you all find the information to sign in? Did you go to our website and I tried to use the link yesterday that I sent and it didn't seem to work. So I know somebody yesterday seemed to have problems trying to find the call-in information. Trying to call in and said he had the incorrect call-in information, but hopefully.
The information that we received at the Coastal Bend Center for Independent Living was forwarded to us from our executive director. And so those who have been joining from Sibsels is from the forward that was actually received by Judy Felge.
Oh, Judy. Okay. Uh-huh. So Judy's probably on one of our listserv lists.
Yeah.
You know, email lists, which is what I sent it to. I sent it to everybody who signed up for Housing and Health Services and the DAW, I believe.
And she forwarded that email to Atlee and to myself.
Okay, great. Okay, great. Well, I hate to wait any longer. It's ten after, and I scheduled these just for an hour to be sensitive to people's time. So let's go ahead and get started. This is our last work group meeting for Work Group 3. Work Group 3 was charged with trying to identify some strategies related to the Technical Assistance Collaborative recommendation, which was to create incentives to expand service-enriched housing. And so each one of these work groups meetings, we've really gone over the entire list because I wanted each one of the work groups to see what the other work group recommendations were. And so I basically just would go through each one of them, and there's a pretty big number of recommendations. And then we can add to, revise, discuss, from there. Does anyone have any issues with doing that? Now, all of you all on the call have all been on, you all have been on previous calls. So do we want to maybe just focus on the work group 3 recommendations first, since you all have heard the previous ones? Does that make sense to anybody?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay, well let's just move to the work group 3 recommendations, and then as others join the call, we can always go back and revisit the work group 1 and work group 2 recommendations. And just want to remind everyone that this call is being recorded, and I have been putting those audios out on the website. So if anyone wants to go back and listen to previous calls, you can do that through our Housing and Health Services Coordination Council website. So starting with work group 3 was about creating incentives to expand service-enriched housing. And so the first bullet is to encourage people with disabilities and advocates to participate in the qualified allocation process, provide specific recommendations to TDHCA staff. And we just talked briefly about that, the qualified allocation plan. It is complex. We already do have incentives currently in the qualified allocation plan. If folks want to look at revising, changing, adding to those incentives, I think what we need to do is to really be able to provide some specific information. Cameron Dorsey, as you all may or may not know, has come a couple of times to our council meetings and has said that we need some specific examples of what you would like to have included. That way we can work on it, we can vet it, and it would be something that they would consider putting in a staff draft. So any comments on that bullet? Okay. Let's move on to the next one, which is to include Section 811 project rental assistance in future qualified allocation plans. I think most of you know that we had some language in the QAP, the 2014 draft, that was providing incentives for properties to participate in that project. The 811, Section 811 PRA, it would be properties who were planning developments in those 7 metropolitan statistical areas. But because we hadn't heard from HUD at the TDHCA board meeting, there was some concern by developers because there was just so much unknown. And so the board opted to delete that from the staff draft, but to consider that for 2015. And so that's something that, and I believe we talked about at our last council meeting. I asked him when this QAP process starts again, and I believe he said July. Is that
the comments? The staff was in July writing the staff draft. We usually have roundtables in August.
Okay.
And then usually the first meeting in September is when the proposed rule goes before the board.
Thanks, Megan. Appreciate that. So that's right around the corner. I can't believe time's flying. This is almost March.
So, Terry?
Yes.
Could you expand a little bit on what the concerns were from the developers? Like what specifically, you know, despite the fact that, you know, HUD may not have gotten specific language to them, like what were they concerned about?
Megan.
Okay, this is Megan. I've been working a lot on our cooperative agreement with HUD. And so, as you know, the 811 program is a pilot. And they don't have any regulations right now that cover that pilot program. It was just the information that was in the NOFA. And some of the information that was in the NOFA that we responded to and we won, you know, was a little vague on certain details. I'll give you one. One thing we've been working on is what level of environmental review would be required to participate in the program. So if we have an existing multifamily project that already went through some level of environmental review. Is that enough, or would a further level of environmental review be needed?
Which costs money.
And so that was one of their concerns, that they would have to. They were unclear what they were agreeing to do.
And that's the cost to the developer.
They were unclear about what the scope of those costs would be. Environmental would be one. There's a computer system that the 811 program, now since we have been told we must use. Back at the board meeting, we had not heard that from HUD. There's a computer program called TRAX, and it's what the Office of Housing uses to keep track of the payments and qualified tenants for other types of multifamily housing programs. But at the time, we didn't know if we were going to be using that system or some other system and what the cost would be. And that's another thing the developers were very concerned about. They didn't know if they were going to have to use TRAX or if it was going to be another system, and would there be a user fee? Would the user fee be on an annual basis? Would the user fee be, on a 5-year basis?
Mm-hmm.
And there were just a lot of questions of that sort that were unanswered at that time, and frankly, some of which are still unanswered by HUD. We continue to work with them, but they did provide us a draft of the cooperative agreement, and us and the 11 other state agencies that were awarded funding provided comments back on that draft, and that was back in December. And we still have not received a final version from HUD.
Okay, so are those concerns by the developers, it sounds like they're just concerned with the program overall. So is that, those were issues they had with participating at all in the pilot?
Well, because they didn't, the way the draft was written, they would have to claim points under the QAP, they would have had to agree to participate.
Okay.
And I think some developers had concerns as a whole with the program, but I think the vast majority of developers really had concerns with what they were agreeing to do. Like, if I agree to do this, it's going to cost me $25,000 a year, let's say. But they didn't know, is it going to, I might not agree to, I might take the risk not to get those points if it's going to cost me $25,000 a year. But if it's only going to cost me $5,000 a year, then I would agree to participate, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to, I'm still fairly new to this, especially the rules process, and I was trying to think, in what kind of situation that, including the extra points would upset developers that were already okay with the program? Is that just because it wouldn't be available to everybody? Or like, for example, if some people had concerns and they felt like they would be, discriminated against if they decided not to participate? I'm trying to understand what the problem would have been just to throw it in there and, to encourage people who were okay with it to
We wanted to have developers who were committed to participating in the process. And if you don't know what you're agreeing to, it's hard for us to say to someone, oh, well, it might only cost you $2,000 a year, but it might cost you $50,000 a year to participate in this process. That's kind of been, and when you make something a point in the QAP, you really are rewarding folks, and that is something that I think the board was very strong in the statement that there, at least our board chair, and made a statement on the record that this will be points in 2015. And it may not be points for future developments in 2015, it may be points for people to when the department releases the NOFA have already agreed and to commit units in their already existing property.
Okay.
So it's going to slow our process down that we didn't include incentive points this time. That's not going to slow our process down.
Originally, in the original
right.
application, there was not a lot of thinking, I don't think, about putting it in the QAP. We all along intended to do a NOFA, a Notice of Funding Availability, for existing properties. It was then subsequent to that thinking that somebody started thinking about, well, let's include it
in the QAP.
In the QAP. So all along we planned to use the NOFA process to get properties. And one other thing, and I won't be able to articulate it well. Kate Moore will kind of articulate it better. But there was also something in that application that was unclear about the rent amounts. And it was something about it was not consistent with how we currently
yes.
do our rent process.
Right.
That maybe turns to people.
So we still have not gotten an answer from HUD. We put in our its application that developers would be allowed and being reimbursed for the hire of the tax credit rent, which is what they're already collecting in their program, or whatever their rent reasonableness. So if they're charging, the lower of those two. So if they're charging everybody else $800 for a one-bedroom apartment, they can't charge our program $920, even if that's something they could collect under the tax credit program. HUD has still not given us an answer that we may use tax credit rents. There's a rent that HUD uses called fair market rent. And in some places in our state, those two differential can be, up to $300 a month difference.
Sure, sure.
And I think that's, it's a feasibility question for a developer. It's one thing if you're asking someone, hey, prioritize these tenants and set aside these units so that when a unit opens up, this tenant is the first on the waiting list. That's one question to ask somebody. It's a lot different question to ask somebody, and you can only have, two-thirds of the rent that you could collect if you didn't do this.
Yeah, that was thank you. That was exactly what Kate mentioned the other day, and I couldn't articulate that.
Well, thank you. I didn't mean to take up too much time. I appreciate the explanation.
Well, I think that's good information. I think the most important thing to think about, though, is 2014 is done. Now we got to look towards 2015. And
the way the HUD has been not as responsive, perhaps, as we would like, I think that let's say we were to get a copy of our cooperative agreement by next month. I mean, really the earliest we would be ready to release the NOFA would be about 6 weeks after that, because you have to go through our contracting just various different processes. And so this isn't really slowing down our process at all, that we didn't include these points.
Okay. So let's move on to number three, the third bullet, is to review possible incentives in the QAP for for-profit corporations. And I know that came up because they're currently, for-profits can apply and do for our housing tax credit properties, right? So I think this bullet was, let's do some, additional incentives for for-profits. To include in the QAP. And I know someone just joined the call. Just for your information, we're working on the Work Group 3 recommendations.
Yeah, this is Marty Masker. I apologize, I'm at the airport, and my plane's late, but I just wanted to listen in. Sorry.
Great. I'm glad you joined, Marty. Great. So the fourth bullet is to review possible incentives for developers who agree to provide an on-site case manager. There's been quite a bit of discussion about that topic, And I know Megan and I looked at our QAP and our multifamily rule after that, and there already is a case management as one of the services that you can select to provide if you opt to get points for a supportive housing development. I think one of the issues was, what does case management really mean, and how do we monitor whether they're actually doing the case management? So that was one of the recommendations, is to look at that more closely and how it might be monitored. Then the other recommendation is to review creating more incentives for deeply affordable housing, which is 20% of the area median family income. And I know Tommy and I just had a conversation about this, because I went back to the QAP. We do have incentives for 30% of area median family income, but I'm not aware that we do have any incentives currently for 20%. So again, that would be providing some recommendations, what that might look like, to TDHCA staff to include in a draft. And I know that the issue that comes with that is then how is that going to, it really plays into the financial feasibility of the property and sustainability of the property, I think would be a fair statement. Bless you. Then the next three actually relate to accessing affordable housing for persons who have criminal histories. And I know in one of the calls there was, I think it was Donnie Green, who's one of our council members, had just gone through the tenant-based rental assistance training. I don't want to say all because I'm not that familiar, but particularly for TVRA, we don't require criminal history checks. What the issue gets down to are the individual properties and their policies related to criminal history. And so
let me make a quick clarification. So the department doesn't directly administer very much TVRA. We have a few old contracts that we might still administer directly, but basically we don't do that activity directly. We use subrecipients. And some of our subrecipients might have policies about criminal background checks.
Okay.
But it's not a TDHCA requirement, except that we have a requirement that any policy or procedure that they might have, you know, meet 504 and fair housing guidelines.
Hi, this is Christina from SIBSOL, and I just kind of wanted to interject. We do have a timber contract here at the Coastal Bend Center for Independent Living, and we do kind of have a little bit of a barrier with that, just because we, like you said, it is up to the individual, you know, apartment complex or wherever they're going to be moving to. We have some of our consumers that aren't, you know, upfront and honest about it. So it does become a problem later, but we don't see, you know, we try to work with them as best as we can.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that there are some properties that are willing to take those vouchers for people with criminal history?
It really just depends on when the occurrence happened. If it's something that happened like maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, they're more accepting of it. But if it's something that's current, then no, they're not. I mean, yeah. It's very unfortunate.
Yeah. I know that one of the things that Mike Goodwin talked about was that it's kind of on an individual basis. I think they use the term lax, that you know, these rules are kind of lax at the properties, and that part of that depends on their vacancy rate. That they might be, you know, if they're having an issue with tenants or vacancies, that they might be more apt to be flexible with some of those rules.
Well, you know, that's also a huge issue when we're trying to get them approved with the NIMBYism is, you know, most of the time you're talking about developers and landlords having to make certain commitments to the neighbors that they won't allow it just because that's part of the approval process, or the city's even. So it's a catch-22, because, you know, as much as we see the people that need it, the cities don't want it, and the neighbors don't want it, and it's really a difficult issue all the way around.
It sure is. Well, the last two bullets, we TDHCA, and there's a number of other agencies, it's a big work group, the Reentry Task Force. And TDHCA does participate in that task force. I believe those meetings are open to the public. They meet irregularly, I want to say a couple of times a year. They do have a housing subgroup where they are trying to look at housing. And one of the callers that was on one of the previous calls for this work group talked about some resources that she was aware that TDHCA had related to rental assistance, transitioning, reentry. And I know that during the last legislative session, TDCJ was allocated additional funding. I think it's 45 new reentry specialists that they have hired. And so one recommendation was to really look at, would there be a way to perhaps partner with TDCJ somehow, something that might look like, a notice of funding availability for properties who are willing to work with TDCJ and TDHCA and perhaps get additional rent subsidy if they allow some folks with criminal histories to live in their properties. And of course, Marty, it comes back to, would we have any takers, especially if they had already made some promises to the neighborhoods and things like that. So it's an ongoing challenge, but
I will say that HUD properties that are developed with HUD, certain types of HUD funding or projects that have project-based rental assistance from HUD have statutory they have both regulatory and statutory things that if you have certain types of fences, you can't live there. Those typically are not as onerous as some of the barriers if, for example, you are in HUD's public housing, but they aren't something that a property owner that has that type of funding can just waive.
Mm-hmm. It's things like, convicted of sexual offense, and then meth
and methamphetamines, and there's other types of drug offenses too.
Mm-hmm.
Certain types of gang activity. That you don't make it through the screening, the federal screening process.
Okay.
And unfortunately, that's some of the majority that we see here in our area. And this is in Corpus Christi.
Those types of offenses you mean, Christina?
Yes.
Or is this Lori?
No, sorry, this is Christina. Yes, those types. Well, I do relocation services here at Sibsol, and that's one of the, we try to help our consumers leave with timber services from the nursing facility, and that's right now one of the big challenges we're having.
Okay, so could I ask a stupid question?
What
do you do? How do you find them housing?
It's very unfortunate. We actually... I think there is one place that will accept these offenders, and it's in Kennedy, I want to say, or Carnes. And so what we've been doing is transferring the consumers that need housing there to that specific property.
Okay.
And have you found that the offenses that are barring people are primarily drug offenses?
No, they're the other offenses.
The sexual assault, that kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I know it is an ongoing challenge, and so one of the recommendations was just to try to continue to work with the Reentry Task Force, TDCJ, to see what creative things we might be able to come up with, but obviously having to stay within statutory requirements. So shall we go back? We still have 25 minutes, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, one of the purposes was to look at what some of the other work groups' recommendations have been. So if we don't have any more discussion about that, I think, Marty, you might be the only one that hasn't heard these yet. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at.
I did go over the list briefly, but go ahead.
Well, and I don't want to waste anybody's time. If everyone has seen the list and we've had discussion about it, maybe if there's some specific things in the list that we want to talk about, we could talk about those. Maybe let me kind of get the conversation going maybe a little bit. On two previous calls, we've had the question come up about the council recommendations. You know, and I've mentioned before about the statute of the council. Mostly, you know, there's four things the statute. It's about policies and processes and technical assistance, education, training, and identifying barriers. So it's really kind of four major areas. And so one of the questions that come up is, are the recommendations that we're going to be putting in this biennial plan just for TDHCA? And my response to that was no. My response to that was, if you look at the definition of service-enriched housing, it is all about housing and services, coordinating, cooperating to ensure that people remain, go back to the community to live as independently as possible. And so one of the things, and you'll look at some of these recommendations, they aren't just for TDHCA. And it was interesting because on one of the calls we had, well, yeah, but it's the priority. If you don't have housing, you don't have anything. I pose back to that individual, but you can have housing, and if you don't have services, that's not going to work either. In many cases, the people that we are looking at need both. They need housing, but they also need support in the community to be able to remain in the community. So why don't y'all tell me what your thoughts are about that, and if I'm off base or... No comments about that, so I'm assuming that means that you agree.
I agree.
Okay. That we need both.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so we all agree that the recommendations that are going to go to the governor and the LBB, we want to talk about services and housing. Because you'll see with the work group one of the things that I plan to include in there, how I've sort of envisioned and kind of started a real rough draft, is looking at starting this biennial plan with what is service-enriched housing. It just the different people I talk to in different work group meetings, I don't think people really understand what it is. And I'm a very simple-minded person, and the way I understand things is give me some examples. So the next section, if you will, of the report is, okay, now that I have an idea of what it is, why is it important? And so one of the things that I want to do is to give some stories. I want to tell about real people, and SIBSIL is the first two examples I have, individuals who lived in nursing homes, some for 12 years, were able to move out of a nursing facility into an integrated, accessible apartment and continue to receive services in the two cases that I've included in the report so far through the HHSC or Health and Human Services STAR Plus waiver program, and able to remain in the community because they were able to access some housing programs, particularly Project Access or tenant-based rental assistance services through TDHCA, and they can then receive services through the housing. Through Health and Human Services. And that's also included North Carolina, some of what North Carolina to where they started their program with the Housing Finance Agency and the Health and Human Service Agencies working together for particular populations. then the next part of the plan is, okay, what have we done? You know, what activities have been going on that lend themselves to or support increasing state efforts to expand service-enriched housing. So you'll see in that work group one, looking at DSH's rental assistance program. They were awarded $12 million this last biennium to provide some rental assistance to individuals in, I think it's, not, I always say the number wrong, either 18 or 19 local mental health authorities. And looking at how successful that program was, they're looking at trying to do an evaluation. But they plan to, their goal was to assist over 500 individuals. In some cases, that might have prevented people going back to an institution. In some cases, it might be people coming out of an institution. And then they all do receive services through that local mental health authority. And so I think that's one of the things that I'm looking at. You'll see in there the balancing incentives payment, so expanding the ADRCs where it's a, excuse me, no wrong door. So I'm really looking at trying to paint a little broader picture of activities on both the housing and the services side, and then taking these recommendations and saying, okay, so now where do we want to go from here? Anybody have any comments?
I'll comment on one piece that I read through the report was additional of housing and service partnership academies.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you, that was incredibly helpful in getting these teams, I think even to understand what they were trying to do, but they're still working together aggressively, and I don't think if that academy hadn't taken place, that would have been the case.
Oh, that's just great to hear. Great to hear. And
the fact that you guys brought out everybody was just really impressive. I think to all the people there, which really I think gave them some hope that there is, you know, and the hope just got them to the point where they're willing to put the work in to try to figure out a solution.
Thank you so much for that comment. I was there. I saw that myself. You know, I sat with my team was from East Texas, never heard of tenant-based rental assistance, had no idea what it was, had no idea what the Amy Young Barrier Removal Program was, and said, oh, gosh, I wish we have people that need ramps and things that they could do to their current home that might prevent someone going into an institution. So I really felt like, and I know there was a follow-up evaluation. And I think the vast majority of people felt that Marty was informational and helpful. And you'll see that recommendation is both in Work Group 1 and Work Group 2. It's to replicate those academies.
Yeah.
Do you think, this is Christina from Simpson, do you think that some areas in Texas will start to utilize the TIBRA, like maybe get training and become facilitators of that program?
I think we've seen an increase in that.
Yeah.
I know that when we just analyzed, and forgive me, I don't remember which year, it was 12 or 13 funding for our home for tenant-based rental assistance, home rehabilitation, and home buyer assistance, those three programs that fall under that home PW people with disabilities set aside, the majority of those funds went to TBRA. And so I do think the word's getting out. There are... Go ahead, Marty.
I had also heard that they've in one case, they actually run out of funding, which they hadn't used up all the funding, I don't think, in years, had they? But I think there was always money that was left on the table.
We're not actually out of funding yet.
Okay.
But we expect to be, for the persons with disability set aside. But that to be very soon.
Yeah, because I was talking to Parker County Affordable Housing, and he said on one of the areas that they serve, they were out of money. And so that was really encouraging. I mean, discouraging for us because we're trying to get more, but encouraging for the fact that people are taking advantage of it.
Yeah, and I think last year's funds, that because I know Jennifer mentioned that, so I think that would have been for 2012. Yes, it was all spent, and that was the first time in years. that it had been. So
we actually ran out of a little bit of the funding for Tibra, but it was not for a very long period of time. It was like maybe a month, and I mean, all of our consumers were set. I mean, we didn't have any problems with that, and it was, but I don't want to say ran out of funding. It seemed like it was maybe 3 weeks or so.
Yeah, I think Jennifer told me it was like 15 days, 12 days.
Yeah.
It was in the teens,
and there's probably going to be a period again where we're out of money, but we expect to get, and I just talked to Jennifer about this yesterday, we expect to get notice of our 2014 award allocation in March 15th or something. And then typically it takes about 60 days after that till we actually get the ability to spend the money, because what happens is HUD has to review your action plan, and then they send you the contract, and then it takes a little while for the money to get wired, and so it's credited to Texas's account. And then it's a little while after that before we can put that money back out.
And we do that through the NOFA process.
We do that through the NOFA process.
It is so rewarding to have Tibra in our area and helping, you know, we utilize it a little bit more for my program, which is relocation. We do help consumers, you know, that come in that need it as well, but what we want to do is make sure that we get everybody in an institution that doesn't want to be there out. So we do use it for relocation a lot more than, you know, the consumer that just walks in, but you know, we try to balance it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you told the Scripps about the good news about Section 8? The new voucher?
No, I have not. I mean, I sent that out on the listserv, but I don't know that everybody's on the listserv.
So as you may know, we have a Project Access Program, which is a permanent voucher under the Section 8 program.
Yes.
And we recently have a really large wait list due to sequestration and a lot of cuts in Section 8 and how they were calculating renewal demand. I mean, just a whole series of things happened in the last 18 months, and we were not able to pull very many people off of our wait list. But now we about 2 months ago?
Mm-hmm. Not even a month ago.
Maybe a month
well,
ago.
In November, we rolled out 21.
Right. And then
I think it was December, maybe. No, January.
January. And then we issued 39 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're looking to potentially issue maybe a few more in March.
Can I ask a question about that? I'm sorry, it's Christine again. How are you issuing, or what is the priority as far as who's getting those vouchers first? Is it who's been on there the longest, or is it just because you have that wait list from 1 to, I think last time I checked was 175 or something like that. Is it the first 40?
So we have identified in our plan to HUD priority population, and Project Access is a priority population. And so in our survey, I apologize, I can't remember the number, 140.
Uh-huh.
Until we're serving 140 people on with Project Access at a given time, the Project Access population that gets the first access to those vouchers, if that makes sense. Then in order of being put on the wait list. And then after that, it's the order on the wait list, including the Project Access voucher. So they're not put in a little pile by themselves. After we have 140, we can't serve anymore. That's not how it works. But it's like then it goes to a general wait list after we have 140. So we still might, because right now more than half of the persons on our wait list are Project Access, the population, even if we got the 140, it would be very likely that the number would be able to issue more, the number would grow beyond 140, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And y'all are still accepting applications for Project Access, correct?
Yeah, we have not closed that wait list. But we also got some good news from HUD last week that we're going to be able, well, two pieces of news. We are going to, starting in March, mid-March or April, manage some 11 or 12 vouchers from another housing authority. And then in either July of this year or January, and that depends on HUD, we will actually absorb those vouchers. And once we absorb the vouchers, then they'll go to our just regular pool. So upon turnover, we'll be able to release those to the project access waitlist until we hit that 140, and then it will just be.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, so that was pretty exciting. And the other good piece of news that we got from HUD is our, it's called a renewal demand calculation. Is actually going up a little bit, but because we're serving more and more percentage of our Section 8 population is project access, and they tend to be one bedrooms, which tend to be, though are not always, less expensive than a two-bedroom apartment. We're actually being able to issue more, because our voucher authority and our funding authority are not the same. So we're actually going to be able to issue more vouchers than we were expecting. We're going to be allowed to issue, serve more people, basically, with the renewal demand. So these are pretty exciting things in our Section 8 world. Yay!
I have a question for you real quick. I apologize. I've got to get off. But is there a possibility of taking the tipper training?
Okay, I'm sorry, Marty, you kind of faded. Is there a possibility of taking the tipper training?
You said that Donnie had talked to the tipper training. I would like to go to the tipper training. I could talk to Donnie about that.
I think that was because she was working closely with that affordable housing in Parker County.
Yeah, that's right.
They expanded the counties included.
Yeah, I was working with her on that project. I just didn't know. I would just like to get more education on TIBRA, so I didn't know. Did she come down to Austin to get trained on that, or was it Parker County? Did she just go through the training with Parker County?
And I'm not sure about that, but let me tell you, the person to talk to is Spencer Duran here at TDHPA, and he's
great.
The one that provides the technical assistance related to, you know, people leaving the project access and, you know, that roadmap process.
Yeah. Yes.
And so I know he could get you in touch with, and I'm not sure exactly how that works if the training is offered once you have contracted with us.
I see.
If you have any questions, Marty, you can always contact anybody here at Coastal Bend Center for Independent Living. I shouldn't say anybody. We actually have our housing specialist, Atlee McCampbell. He's very knowledgeable as well. So if you have any like specific questions, I'm sure he would not mind you emailing him as well.
That would be great. I'm going to go ahead and get off there. They're making me shut off my phone. I apologize, but I'll let you go. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marty. Have a good flight.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Okay, do we have anybody else having any comments? Does everyone feel okay with these recommendations? And obviously I will, you know, consolidate the ones that are, you know, redundant and get a little cleaner list. Okay, I encourage any and all of you to sign up for the council email list, because I do send quite a bit of information through that email list. I think we have close to 1,200 or 1,300 people that are on that list now. So encourage you to sign up for that. And there's nothing else. Appreciate everybody's time and input, and know that this won't be the last time. Next step is to get a draft. Our council will be meeting again April 16th. I hope to have a draft ready by then for everyone to look at. Then we're also going to be doing an online discussion group. We're also going to be taking the draft plan on the road to a couple three different towns to be able to do some public hearings. So there'll be more time to provide input. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Good weekend.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.